Matthew chapter 2, verse 1 through to 12, which is where I'm reading from, and it says the following. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star that they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. And then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. It's God's word to us this morning as we continue just exploring the Christmas story and a kind of the idea of searching. And here we have the Magi searching for the one that has been born King of the Jews. I've mentioned over the last couple of weeks that the early church father, Augustine, St. Augustine, he's recorded as having said, "God, our hearts are restless until such time as they find their rest in you." I'm not sure if he was drawing directly from Ecclesiastes 3:11, but it kind of has the echoes of Ecclesiastes 3:11 in it, where the teacher writes in that passage in chapter 3:11, he says, "He, God, also set eternity in the hearts of humankind, in the hearts of men and women." So in other words, God, when he fashioned us and created us, he's placed eternal longings in every single human being, or a longing for the eternal in every human being. It's something that is hardwired into us. There's something inside of us, an innate knowledge that says to us, do you know what, there's got to be more to life than the things that I can taste and see and touch and consume and acquire and achieve, you know, on and on. There's got to be more to all of these different things that I might amass in my life. And basically, these two expressions, Augustine's phrase and what the teacher writes in Ecclesiastes, basically, I think they're expressing that in each of us there is a longing for God, because we're made for relationship with God. And until such time as we have that relationship with God as Father through Jesus Christ the Son, our hearts are restless, skipping from one thing to the next, trying to find meaning, purpose, and so on in our lives. And I'm not sure if this is where the Magi begin their story, you know, as they're kind of drawn into the Christmas story. I'm not sure if this is where they're at. They wake up one morning and they've got this restlessness of heart, and so they decide to go on this journey following the star and that sort of thing. Probably not. You know, it's probably not where their story begins. Probably they were like the shepherds that we looked at last week, who were just going about their business when God stepped into their story and decided to script them into his story. The only difference is they're nothing like the shepherds. The Magi are nothing like the shepherds. The shepherds were just ordinary men, part of the covenant people of God, yes, but just ordinary men, really, from the bottom of the barrel of Jewish society. Whereas the Magi, sometimes called kings, sometimes called wise men, but probably just best that we stick with Magi, the Magi are men from the top of society's barrel. They're men of influence. They're men of power. They're not part of the covenant people of God, but they're from the east, likely the kingdom of Persia. So that's about 800 kilometers to the east, and as their title suggests, they're magi. And we like to romanticize it and that sort of thing in Christmas cards, but the word magi actually translates sorcerer. They're magicians. They're sorcerers who watch the stars in order to interpret their moving and meaning and therefore deduce from that future events. And God grabs a hold of their lives and he brings them into his story. He takes the one thing that he knows will get their attention and he places a star in the sky that then gets their attention because they're men that watch the stars and interpret the moving and meaning of the stars. And when you read through different commentaries and that sort of thing, which I like to do, you know, different commentators try and puzzle together how this might have worked. Because, I mean, you know, it's just a star in the sky, right? You know, so how did they know that they need to follow that star because of X, you know, and so on? And they bring sort of all of Scripture together to try and paint this picture. And so the commentators will sort of point out, well, maybe these guys knew about the prophecy of Balaam, which you can read about in Numbers chapter 24, verse 17. Because Balaam lived in a town called Pethor, which is on the Euphrates River, which is right next door to Persia. So maybe they were aware of Balaam's prophecy, which basically says, a star will rise out of Jacob, a scepter or a ruler out of Israel. And then maybe they know about the writings of the prophet Daniel. Probably more likely they know about the writings of the prophet Daniel, because Daniel was in the kingdom of Persia. When he was in exile, he was in the kingdom of Persia. He was the chief in the court of seers in the kingdom of Persia. And so they would have known about Daniel's prophetic writings, which we have in our Old Testament. And they would have known then about what we have as chapter 9, verse 24 through to 27, which speaks about the anointed one that will be born, the Messiah that will come, and gives us kind of really complicated timeline as to when it is that the Messiah would be born. And so they bring these things together, the star that has come in the sky, that they've recognized in the sky, that they interpret as his star. They say the King of the Jews has been born. These prophetic writings are coming together. And so they begin on this kind of pilgrimage, really, to go and find the one who has been born, the King of the Jews. And they come not because of a restlessness of heart or anything, but I think really with a curiosity. They want to see if this is right. They want to come and pay homage, perhaps curry favor with the new leader of that town, of that nation, and so on. And little do they know that as they're scripted into God's story, their life is going to connect with other stories as well. It's going to have a knock-on effect. And the first person that they have a knock-on effect with is King Herod. And he's just going about, I guess, his normal business, doing whatever it is that kings do. And the Magi turn up in his city and say, hey, we're looking for the one that's just been born, King of the Jews. That's not going to go down well, is it? You know. And the Bible tells us that in the NIV, it says that Herod was disturbed. Some of the other translations say that he was frightened and all of Jerusalem with him. And I think the reason why all of Jerusalem is frightened is because Herod is frightened and disturbed. And so they are frightened and disturbed. I guess his life was just going along pretty nicely up until this point. He was in charge of quite a bit of economic reform in Jerusalem and in Israel. He was sort of living at peace under the Roman rule and so on. He had managed to sort of get on side with the religious elite and so on. He was instituting economic reforms, which were doing good things for the economy. He had a few building projects on the go. One of the major ones was the expansion of the temple and so on. And now on this particular day, maybe he woke up that morning and thought, today's going to be a good day. And then the Magi step into his story. And what they do in saying, we're looking for the King of the Jews, is I think they press that big red button on Herod's chest, the one that we have, you know, where people trigger us. You know, have you ever had that happen? You know, kids are great at doing this, you know. They press the big red button on the parents' chest in order to trigger them. They say, just the things that will trigger their parents and so on. And they say, we're looking for the King of the Jews. And this triggers Herod because Herod has got a dark side. I mean, things are going well for him. He's, you know, got all these things on the go, but he's got this dark side, which if ever there is any kind of political rivalry that will threaten his reign and rule, he stomps it out mercilessly. And so the Jewish historian Josephus, talking about Herod, he tells the stories. He talks about how Herod murdered his brother-in-law, or had him murdered by drowning him in the pool by the palace. Talks about how he murdered his wife, Mariamne, and their two sons because he kind of thought that maybe they would threaten his rule. He killed 46 members of the Sanhedrin, so the Jewish ruling council, because he thought that they might threaten his rule. Caesar Augustus is apparently recorded as saying it would be safer to be Herod's pig than it would be one of his sons, because at least a pig can't threaten his rule. And so he's threatened. He's disturbed. And so his story then has a knock-on effect on the teachers of the law and the scribes and the Pharisees, because he calls them together. And he says, look, you need to find out for me quickly, where is it that the Messiah is born? And the Magi are often called the wise men in the story and that sort of thing. But actually the true wise men are the Pharisees and the teachers of the law and so on, because they're the ones that know the facts. They're the ones that know about the Messiah and when the Messiah is to be born and all this sort of thing. So as Herod gets them together and poses the question, tell me where the Messiah is to be born, they're like, that's easy, it's Bethlehem. The prophets have spoken about this. It's in Bethlehem where it's going to happen. Bethlehem, which is about 5 miles south of Jerusalem. So in other words, Herod, it's just happened right underneath your nose. Bethlehem, which is interestingly translates as the house of bread, where the bread of life will be born. Bethlehem is the place where Jacob buried Rachel and built a memorial to her. It's the place where Boaz fell in love with Ruth. It's the place where David would ultimately be born. So it gets called the city of David. David, who becomes King David, who God makes a covenant with and says to him, you will never fail to have a ruler sit on your throne. And I will establish your kingdom as an everlasting kingdom. Bethlehem, the place where the Messiah, the anointed one, will come from. And so Herod, now armed with this information, he goes back to the Magi in secret and he says to them, okay, so I've got it. It's in Bethlehem. That's where you need to go to. But when you go there, make sure you come back to me and tell me, once you found the child, so I too can go and worship him. You know. And the Magi set off and they come and they find the star stops where the child is, and they come and they encounter Jesus. And I want you to notice that two things happen in this encounter. We've said often, again, you know, one of our pursuits as a church is we pursue an encounter with God. Why? Because it changes us. And you notice this happening in the story. As they encounter Jesus, two things happen. The first one is this, that they're overjoyed. There's just a sense of joy. Did you not experience this when you met Jesus through the gospel? Was there not a sense of joy that sprang forth in your life, right? And so they're overjoyed. And maybe that joy is as a result of we've made it. Right? Maybe that's all it is. Maybe they're like, we saw the star, we knew the prophetic writings, we put 2 and 2 together, it equals 4. We've gone on this long and arduous journey, dangerous journey, costly journey. We've finally arrived at our destination. It's everything that we expected. High fives all around. Brilliant. We made it. And therefore, we have great joy. You ever experienced this? Yeah? All right? You go on, do something and you manage to achieve it and so on. It's just like, yeah, brilliant. We did it. All right? Or maybe, and this is where my mind perhaps leads toward a little bit, maybe something happens in this first encounter. Maybe God, who has scripted them into his story, who Paul would later write about, saying in 2 Corinthians, God who said, let light shine out of darkness. Maybe God has made his light shine into the hearts of the Magi to give them the light of the knowledge of the glory of God, and they see it shining in the face of Jesus, and their natural reaction is just to respond with joy. I guess we can't be sure, but the second thing that happens to them is they bow down in worship. Joy turns to worship, and they bow down in reverence. They pay homage. It's an act of obeisance towards Jesus. And that worship that they express is perhaps not as we've done this morning in singing and clapping and that sort of thing, singing songs and what have you, but their expression of worship is to offer gifts. And so often when you read sort of devotionals and that sort of thing, people will attach all sorts of meaning to these gifts as they relate to Jesus. So you would have heard this stuff before. They gave him gold because gold is fit for a king and Jesus is a king. Have you heard this one? Right, and they gave him frankincense because frankincense is an incense that's used in temple worship, and so Jesus is worthy of our worship, so they give that as a symbol. You've heard that one, right? And the myrrh is a symbol of the death that Jesus will die, and so on, and the embalming that will take place and that sort of thing. But I wonder if that's right. I wonder if these gifts that they give to Jesus actually say more about them. So the gold that they're bringing is gold that they've made, wealth that they have amassed through their job as sorcerers and magicians and those that read the stars. It's a symbol of their wealth that they are giving. And maybe the incense and the frankincense that they bring is not a symbol of worship to Jesus, but a symbol of their temple worship that they come from. And the myrrh is an embalming spice, which they then come and they bring to Jesus. And sometimes we attach all sorts of symbols to what these different things, the gold, the frankincense, and the myrrh might mean, and we miss the main point, which is that they're bringing something of themselves and they're laying it at the feet of Jesus, which is what is at the heart of worship. I like what one author said, they hand over the symbols of their interest, surrendering them to the newly arrived Lord of heaven and earth. Finds its kind of echo, I think, in Romans chapter 12, verse 1 through to 3, you know, where Paul says, therefore I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy. So in other words, in view of the previous 11 chapters, in view of the fact that you are dead and lost in your transgressions, and there you are absolutely powerless to save yourself, in view of the fact that God has stepped into your life in the work and person of Jesus, and that he has offered his perfect life as an atoning sacrifice for your sin in order to reconcile you to God. In view of that great mercy that you do not deserve, Paul is saying, in view of that mercy in the gospel, offer your life as a living sacrifice. The gift of worship that we bring to God is our whole lives. And for the Magi, this is their expression of that. They're bringing this gold, the frankincense, and myrrh, and they're laying it down before him and saying, as a sign of their worship. And we too, who have seen the glory and the light of God shining in the face of Jesus through the gospel, we have the immense privilege of being a people who overjoyed come into the presence of God and bring our whole lives and say, God, my whole life is an offering of worship to you. That's my spiritual act of worship. As the story moves on from this place of where they're bowing down in worship, the story moves on, and then there's a dream that happens, and the Magi go home in a different route rather than telling Herod. But that has a knock-on effect, because then Herod comes, and it's a fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy, and there's real tragedy and heartache in the story. As hope comes into the world, it's in the midst of heartache and tragedy as Herod tries to blot out any political rivalry, killing all the children under the age of 2. And then Matthew carries on with his story. But before we just kind of skip on to the next part and that sort of thing, what I want us to do this morning is I want us to take a step back from the story that is just so familiar to us and to ask a really simple question, which is, what's the big idea? Right, as we look at the story that we've probably heard, if you've been around church for any length of time, you've heard the story again and again. You hear it every year, right? So, you know, but let's just take a step back from it and ask ourselves a question. So what's the big idea? Out of all the material that was available to Matthew, why is it that he takes this story, which is unique to his gospel? It's not told in any of the other gospels. Why does he take this story and include it in his gospel? What's the reason behind that? And I guess if we had to all put our heads together, we'd come up with, I don't know, a whole bunch of different reasons. But let me just suggest to you three this morning, which we can maybe take away and apply to our lives and our pursuits that we have as a church and so on. Reason number one why I think Matthew includes this is because he wants to show us that God will use whatever it takes to get a hold of people. God will use whatever it takes to get a hold of people, to draw them into his story, to draw them closer to him. I mean, if you think about it, this story would have made sense if Luke had included this story in his gospel, because when Luke writes his gospel, he writes to a Gentile audience, and this is a story about Gentiles, right? So it would have made sense, because Luke writing it to Gentiles, and the Gentiles would have seen, brilliant, we're included in this story. That's great. But Matthew includes the story, and his audience that he's writing to is predominantly a Jewish audience. And you can be sure that when they read it for the first time, they were thinking, nah, this is not the way it gets done. God's not going to use a Gentile in his story in this way. Matthew, you're doing fine, the genealogy and everything. Love that. That was brilliant. Fantastic. Chapter 2, we're not so sure about. We think you should edit this part out of the story because God doesn't work like that. God works through us, the chosen people. God works through us, the elect. We're the ones that are filled with blessing to go and be a blessing to all other nations. If you had said that he was working through a Jewish man, no problem, but we're not so sure about this Magi business and including them in the story. And are we not sometimes the same? Where we prescribe ways in which God must work and limit God to the ways that he can work? So we come up with all these ideas of how to reach people, and it's got to be done through getting people into church. You know, make sure they get a nice welcome at the door, and that will be the thing. That's how God works through that. Or maybe it's through social action. We do all sorts of different social action in order to reach people. That's how God works. Or maybe we need to have a whole lot of evangelistic events and that sort of thing, and solid preaching of the gospel and whatever, because that's the way that God works. Or maybe it's through liturgy or sacrament or whatever. Those are the prescribed ways that God works. And the reality is God will work through all of those ways, but he's not going to be confined to it. He's not going to be limited to just working in those ways. God adapts himself to those he calls, and he's willing to be found by all who will recognize that he's drawing them closer. You know, for the Magi, the one thing that's going to get their attention is a star in the sky, and God says, well, we'll do that. We'll put in the star in the sky, and we'll lead them on this journey. For me, it was a moment sitting in a room in Bessels Green in a church there on an Alpha course, and just as we began to pray together, having this overwhelming sense, not only of the weight and of my guilt and sin, but then wonderfully the lifting of that sense of guilt and sin and the sense of God saying, you're forgiven. I forgive you. For C.S. Lewis, who was so clever and had so many different arguments to kind of disprove God, he eventually got to the end of his tether and he realized, you know what, I have no more arguments left to disprove God or say that God doesn't exist. And so in one of his books, he says, I reluctantly accepted the lordship of Jesus. You know, for stories that I've heard about some Muslims, you know, they no Bible, no church, nothing. And they talk about a man in white who visited them and pointed them in the right direction in a dream. For somebody who loves creation, you know, the psalmist tells us that the heavens proclaim the glory of God. And so it's through this that they get drawn in and God grabs their attention and they begin to go on a journey. For the scientist, maybe it's the gathering of all the facts and there's this moment that they just come to this realization. There must be someone behind all of this. The point is God will do whatever it takes to get our attention. He might not necessarily work the way that we always anticipate that he will work, but he will work in such a way to get our attention, to draw us closer to him. And then this has practical application for us. Practical application is we pursue personal evangelism on our front line. God has uniquely placed you in the place where you are to use you to bring others to him. Could you be the star in the sky or the star on your front line that God has placed in the lives of other people who don't know him that will then draw them to him? The calling for us is to make a difference wherever we are, to be people that God, to just say, God, I'm open to being used by you to draw others to you, you, the author of life. Matthew wants us to know that, hey, God will do whatever it takes to get hold of people. He will even go so far as to send his one and only son, Jesus, into the world to die for us. I think Matthew wants us to know that God is near. See, this is not a story about a star and magi and Herod and religious leaders figuring things out. It's not a story about human achievement or anything like that. It's a story about God's presence. It's a story about God stepping in. It's a story about Emmanuel. It's a story about God with us. A story about God who loves humankind so much that he's unable to stand by and watch as sin ravages those who are made in his image. God who's not content to sit idly by and let us grope and chase after the next thing in attempt to settle the restlessness in our heart. God is not content to live separated from us, and so He gives the greatest gift imaginable, His one and only Son, Jesus, who willingly humbles Himself and is made in human likeness, human form, that we remember in the story. The one who comes and lives the perfect life that you and I couldn't live, and then dies the death that you and I did deserve, so that a way could be opened, that we might come in repentance and faith and have life. Life in all its fullness. And our hearts that have been restless up until this point, our hearts set at ease, and our hearts encountering peace, and our hearts overflowing with joy. Joy that's not anchored to the circumstantial things in our lives and what we do or don't get for Christmas and that sort of thing, but joy that is anchored to the eternal lordship of Jesus, the one who is immovable, unshakable, the one who will be faithful in every single circumstance of our life. Matthew wants you to know God will use whatever it takes to draw you near. He wants you to know that God is near. But then finally, I think what Matthew wants us to see here is that it's all about worship. When you boil it all down, it's all about worship. Out of all creation, humankind have been uniquely made for relationship with God, expressed by worship and devotion to God. And the Magi represent the first of many characters throughout Matthew's gospel. It's a theme that's going to track the whole way through Matthew's gospel. The Magi are the first of many characters who are going to come and bow down in reverence and worship before Jesus, recognizing that here is one in whom God is present. But alongside that theme of people bowing down in worship is going to be the theme of how people respond differently to Jesus. You see, not everybody in the story bows down in worship, right? You have all these different responses that are happening in this story. The Magi see the star, and they go on the journey, and they search, and they find Jesus, and it results in being overjoyed, which then leads to worship, and this is their response. But King Herod, he hears the news of the one that's been born, the King of the Jews, and his response is to be disturbed, to be frightened, which then spills over into naked aggression and an evil. A kind of real a desire to want to blot out any chance of the King of the Jews. And then the bit that is, I guess, the most shocking for me is the teachers of the law and the Pharisees and their response. I mean, out of all people, those who studied the scriptures, out of all of them, they should have been the ones who were like, yes, the Messiah has come. Could this really be? Oh, that's amazing. Magi, we're coming with you to Bethlehem. We'll take you. We'll show you how to get there. And we'll take you to all the best restaurants on the way and everything. We just want to be a part of what's happening here. But there's just a blind indifference. A blind indifference to the greatest news imaginable that they should have been shouting from the rooftops. And I wonder if any of these finds its echo in our own lives as we respond to the one who is born King of Kings this Christmas. I mean, what is our response? What has our response been during the course of this week? What is our response going to be next week? And last week, as we finished, I was saying, look, you know, I encourage you, just behold Jesus. Take time just to behold the wonder of the one who is God with us. Emmanuel. But what has been our response to Jesus during this week? Has it been joy? Has it been worship? Kind of expressed in the way that we've lived our lives and the way that we've spent time with Him and the way that we've prayed and sought His face? Has it been that we're a little bit disturbed? A little bit frightened, maybe? Because we feel that the lordship of Jesus is cramping our style somewhat. And we're actually just a little bit fed up of picking up our cross and following Him, denying ourselves in order to follow Him. Or maybe it's just indifference. It's another Sunday, right? It's the story of the Magi. We've heard this, you know, from Sunday school all the way through. We know the ins and outs of the story. It's just another Christmas. Listen, God is near. God is near, and He wants nothing more than to grab our attention and to bring us in close and to say to us, hey, look, I want you not just to know through memory verses and that sort of thing, good as that may be. I don't want you to just know. I want you to experience the breadth of my love for you, the height of my love for you, the depth of my love for you, the length of my love for you, this all-encompassing love that I want to show you through my Son, Jesus Christ. God wants us to experience this and to know that we are His children. Those that have put their trust in Jesus Christ, we're His children, loved by Him. But that invitation is open for all who will come in repentance and faith and seeking Him. And that in doing so, our response would then be joy, indestructible joy, and worship.